while we're considering it. I'm just thinking of trying to
meld a couple of things.
Try to move this thing forward so that we aren't caught short if we happen to have an opportunity.
Well, I don't think we would be. You know, if somebody came forward and said we want to use that building for a training facility,
mm-hmm.
I think that could be permitted now without any involvement from. Well, whether it needs to go to you is a decision that hasn't been made yet, but there's a chance it may not need to come to you if that's all they're doing is using that building for a training facility. If there are other site improvements they're proposing, it might need to come to you for review. It wouldn't need to go to the council because, as I said earlier, there's a non-conforming use there now. It's a use that's existing, the training facility. It's non-conforming, which sets up some limitations because it is a non-conformity. You can't expand it, you know, without meeting certain conditions and all that. So, but even if another use comes in that's not industrial, not allowed, we have the tools to deal with that right now in our ordinance. That's contract zoning. It's just a little longer process, but it works. So I wouldn't ask the board necessarily to expedite this process of adding conditional uses in there. I want you to think more about what sort of uses you think might be okay to recognize as conditional uses. You know, I need to get some input from you before I draft something because I'm flying blind otherwise. I don't really know what you think might be okay as a conditional use in that district. So if you give that some thought, and we can talk more about it at the next meeting.
Good. Yeah.
I have one more question. Any delay or any speeding up of this process is what we just discussed. Do you anticipate that would impact any of the brownfield grant money or any of that kind of activity? Could it enhance it, or could it cause it more problems?
No, it wouldn't cause it more problems because this money is solely for the planning and development of that area. Any monies that we would get, so for example, a few spots have been identified on the property as needing phase two remediation. So that money would come from grants, thanks to in part to this. So sitting in on this board for this grant is the EPA, is the DEP. They come to and attend all meetings. Because it is a brownfield site, as well as the Hancock County Planning Commission, as well as the Environmental Study Group, Richard Campbell, who did the environmental study. So the monies to enhance, make things work, that would be coming from other avenues. This is solely for the planning and development of the next phases. So that would not,
right.
But it may.
What about the marketing end of it?
That part it could. We're not going to be officially starting until April 1st. I would say we'd probably be nice to know by June.
Agent.
I'm sorry, sir.
We aren't the real estate agent.
That's,
we don't own the property.
That is absolutely correct, and that's the important thing to remember is that we don't aim is, however, and Jeff McGlynn and I are working together on a bunch of different projects, some more closely. But I think that's a most valid point is to remember that the property is owned entirely by AIM. But anything that we can do to show that we're there, I think, is very helpful.
Thank you. That's why I really would like to get this thing expedited and stay as flexible as we possibly can. And provide, you get that done before the marketing, because they're planning their full implementation around July 1st. Is that when, I know it starts April 1st, but they've got a schedule from what I've seen to have a person on site and up and running. And I assume that will probably be June or July 1st before that happens. So they're going to go and hire the person.
Yeah.
So I'm just looking at the marketing aspect of it and be able to provide them with that information that there is flexibility here. It isn't just tied into one zone. And I understand the contract and condition. I really do. I would just like to get this from my standpoint, be as flexible as I can at all points.
I think it would be helpful for when the focus groups do happen for the citizens to know what we have, this is what's available here. And but again, AIM is still also the property owner, but it would be helpful for they're called charrettes, where the town gets together and all the citizens and the AIM development about what potentially could be. To answer the question about what's needed now, the only thing at this point that's non-conforming is the one use that's been mentioned this evening. Every other use that we're talking with,
it's not non-conforming yet until it changes hands.
Until it changes hand or until it loses its appearance?
No, I mean, just because I didn't tear it down doesn't mean it wasn't still part of the original property. And it was fine, right where it was, doing what it was. It's not non-conforming right now. It only becomes non-conforming if somebody wants to use it, buys it, and uses it differently.
Same in the lease situation, or is that... So if I propose to lease that building, is that still a conforming use, or does that now become a non-conforming use because I'm leasing
what's
it?
What's going to happen in the building.
Okay.
You know. But it may have been, quote, a training center, but it wasn't an educational facility. It was part of the mill. It was an ancillary product. It was needed for the purpose of the mill. Whether it's safety training, sexual harassment, whatever, you know, that's part of that mill. That hasn't changed. That building's still sitting there. It hasn't been torn down.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
How did it become a training facility under the mill without having a permit that stated that it was going to be a training facility? Didn't it get permitted through the town to be a training facility?
It was permitted under our prior land use ordinance, first of all, and which had a totally different set of requirements. And it was permitted as an employee development center, which was, as Ed pointed out, an accessory use to the mill. It wasn't a standalone use. I mean, it is now, because the mill's gone now. So this building sits there as its own building that has its most recent use was a training facility, which, as an educational use, is non-conforming in that district.
Okay, and the entity that wants to move in there is going to use it for a training facility, mm-hmm. not necessarily education, training facility.
Yeah.
So it's actually...
Well, that's an educational use. You're training, you're learning things. So that's an educational activity. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's possible that that can happen without any planning board approval. It really depends on what they're proposing to do. I have not received any written description of exactly what anybody wants to do with that building. So when that time comes, the decision will be made about whether or not it's allowable, and if so, who needs to approve it, or does it need approval at all? So those questions are not answered right now.
So the possibility is there that it can be used in the capacity they want to use it, just like the mill used it in that capacity.
It's recognized now for that use.
That's all I just wanted to know. Thank you.
Anything else?
So next meeting you'll give me some more direction about conditional use aspects. So, the next item on under administrative business is the proposed dimensional changes in the downtown Shoreland District that has to do with the request that this board made to DEP to eliminate certain dimensional standards. DEP came back and said that they're okay with going to zero shorefront requirements. They told me that after the last meeting that this board had. I had a long phone discussion with them, and that's when they shared with me that they have no problem with going to zero shorefrontage. Going to zero minimum lot size, though, is a problem for them. They don't want to go down to zero. You may recall, I shared that with you at the last meeting, and you came back with a 1,000-foot minimum lot size to be applicable to just the principal structure, not to uses in the structure, which is their, is how they do it now under DEP guidelines. They made an interesting comment they want us to consider. Now, I'm not quite sure why, but I can't figure out where they're coming from. But part of our discussion had to do with their fear that if they allow a 1,000-square-foot lot, that people who have larger lots will divide them into 1,000-square-foot lots for their economic benefit. They think, they don't want that to happen because they think the result will be an overburden of uses on Main Street. I tried to explain to them that we wouldn't let that happen, first of all, that have too many uses on Main Street that would result in excessive burden or any burden at all. And one point I made is you might have a 5,000-square-foot lot, for example, that an owner could theoretically build one large building on that lot, 5,000-square-foot building, just for simplicity. What difference would there be if you build 5,000-square-foot building versus dividing that lot into 5 1,000-square-foot lots, each of which has a 1,000-square-foot building? You still have a 5,000-square-foot footprint. And they really couldn't answer that scenario. So, but they would like to know if the board would consider, and this doesn't make sense to me, but they don't know if you would consider if they allow a 1,000-square-foot lot minimum to not allow any 1,000-square-foot lots to be created.
Quick question. Didn't the 1,000-square-foot number actually come from them as a suggestion and a response to you in that email chain?
Well, yeah, that was the lowest number. They laid out several scenarios of how many uses you could have per X square feet. And they started at 5,000, 10,000, I think. They had 5,000, 2,500, and went down to 1,000. Okay. That was the smallest scenario that they laid out. So that's why we use that figure of 1,000.
Okay.
But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to say you can have a minimum of 1,000-square-foot lot, but you can't have a 1,000-square-foot lot. You can't create one. That does not make sense to me.
Good question. Do you know the square footage of all the lots in question? Pretty much, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You could put a limitation on any lot from 0 to 5,000, minimum lot size would be, the minimum use size would be 1,000. Any lot 5,000 to 10,000, you could go to 2,500 square foot and go that way. Because I don't think you'd have too many. And go through too many lots over 5,000 square feet along there.
Well, there are more, most of the lots are over 1,000 square feet in size.
Yeah. So you know you aren't pretty much going to get below the 1,000. Right, but I'm trying to take out the ability to take 5,000 square foot lots, five lots, just for the gain of the owner, versus and all different uses. So, if the lot is more than five, or set more than five to ten, I'd go up to an increase to 2,500 square foot. You know,
if I'm hearing you correctly, and if you had a 5,000 square foot lot, you could divide that once into 2,500 square foot lots. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And that's it. No further decisions.
Right.
I'm worried about any limitation at all of what.
Yeah,
how you divide your properties. Because you might want to sell a piece of your property to your neighbor for whatever reason. And if you have that limitation, you wouldn't be able to do that. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me to have that restriction, but that's what they're looking at now. They're asking us if we would consider not allowing any of the current lots we have on Main Street to be divided. Or at least to be divided into 1,000 square foot lots.
On the shoreline side.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
This is so complex, it's hard to...
When
you start thinking about this, you think about that possibility, and you start thinking about things like view sheds and vertical and all that kind of stuff. I wonder if you're going to... You know, I just envisioned a bunch of pencil buildings or something going up in four stories.
Little spaghetti houses.
And then you're trying to fight fires with houses that are close, and how much distance. It's like, oh, I don't know. I can't wrap my head.
Some countries are calling
some of this stuff. Because I begin to think
5,000 square foot lot's not very big.
No.
I mean, 50 by 100. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's it. It's just...
Build a cottage around.
Wow.
Maybe build a cottage around.
Yeah. I don't know. I just don't know. I really, to be honest with you, I'm not crazy about these phone calls either. And I believe what you're saying, but I would like to see all this in writing as to what they're proposing.
They called me, didn't warn me at all. They were calling. It was actually there were two of them on the other. There was the Shoreland Zoning Coordinator that covers this area, and his boss, the district manager for DEP. Both of them were on the line, catching me totally off guard.
Ganging up on you, weren't they?
So
it's too bad you couldn't recorded the call.
Well, I didn't think of it, but...
No, I'm not criticizing you.
We talked about a half hour, I think.
I just wish they'd put something in writing before I agreed to anything like that. I'm sure they would eventually. If anything, this is one of the items on the agenda tonight, Mr. Chairman, that I would really like some time to think about before I comment on that.
That's fine. There's no rush on that.
Really complex.
Yeah, no rush, but my suggestion is that we reject that proposal to regulate how lots are divided. I don't think it's necessary. If they're concerned about overdevelopment, then maybe there's some other mechanism we can add in the ordinance to deal with that. I don't think we should be telling people how they can buy their properties. As long as they meet the minimum lot size, they should be allowed to do that.
We come up, and I don't remember the lady's name, but she was here. She's got a property, and she can't use it. She can't change it to to make some money. So how do we best help them, but kind of satisfy the needs of DEP? I don't know.
I do like what we offer them. 1,000 feet is... That was good.
So if you're not ready to take a position on this, we can table that and talk about it next month more. Like I said, there's no big rush on this. We'll move on.
Please.
Our last item under administrative business. Now, Chris has been waiting patiently all evening to do this.
I thought he just came to be here and participate.
This is a presentation that City of Bangor's Planning Board had from their assistant city solicitor on how the board deals with the right to know law. I thought it would be interesting and helpful for this board too to get a refresher course on this. They do this annually in Bangor for their planning board. It lasts for about 15 minutes. Hopefully, you'll get something out of it. Here it is.
I'm going to fall asleep.
We have lunch.
And it's 175 Fruit Street, Cameron Stadium, City of Bangor, applicant. Site development plan proposal to construct in addition to Cameron Stadium's existing facilities building, originally approved in 2013. Final structure is 140-foot structure in a government and institutional service district.
This presentation is going to start just
space
shortly
district,
here.
City of Bangor School Department. Do we have a motion to approve the consent on the freezer? Okay. Right.
A second.
Okay, and a motion and a second. Further discussion. All those in favor? All right. Consent agenda item passes unanimously. Item 2, annual orientation. Please, Mr. Nicholas.
Thank you. My name is Paul Nicholas. I'm the Assistant City Solicitor for the
City of Bangor, and I'm here to do the annual orientation regarding some procedural matters and some issues that we will hopefully avoid for the next year. For the most part, a lot of them talking about is going to be dealing with potential Freedom of Access Act problems, things like illegal meetings, due process problems, such as having, which is basically about having information that others don't, and bias problems, which have to do with improperly favoring one side or another. Most of these things have to do with questions that have arisen one way or another over the years that I've been around. A couple of procedural quirks first. As you may already know, in general, the planning board needs 4 affirmative votes to pass a project. That's often the majority if you have 7 people here, or even 6 people. But sometimes we end up with only 5, which is the quorum. We still need 4 affirmative votes in that circumstance. A few things first dealing with outside of the meeting issues. Planning board meetings and any subcommittee meetings are public. They have to be advertised, they have to be open to the public. And one of the things that leads to is that there cannot be discussions or action outside of advertising meetings. That includes before or after meetings. In general, don't discuss planning board business outside of the actual meeting when meeting business is supposed to be discussed. Doesn't mean you can't talk to each other out of meetings and talk to each other socially about other matters, just private board talk about planning board things. There are both Freedom of Access Act issues that can arise if we talk about matters outside of this. There can also be due process issues. If you have a couple of planning board members who are discussing, potentially putting together reasons for making a decision one way or another outside of the meeting, it's not exactly fair to have a discussion going on there. Applicants and potential opponents can't. This includes email reply. Sometimes you'll see David might send out an email to everyone, then someone will reply all to that. In general, for procedural matters, for non-substantive matters, when is the meeting? It's at 7:30 this week. Oh, I thought it was at 7. That's not a problem. But anything that could possibly be considered substantive in a way, and sometimes you do get to important procedural issues, but for the most part, those minor procedural issues aren't really worried about. But substantive or really big procedural issues, hey, let's all, I think we should do a motion to reconsider that last application or something like that. That's not really for coming out with a lot of that sort of thing. Secondly, decisions have to be made on evidence in the record. One important aspect of this is avoiding ex parte contacts, which just means don't talk to applicants or other people about projects outside of the meeting. Anyone who might possibly be involved in the project. Don't visit sites to see for yourself, and sometimes we'll get questions about this. If you drive past a particular site every day on your way to work, it's kind of hard to avoid at least seeing that the site. But don't make any particular effort to inspect it. And if you think you have any information that other people on the board, that the applicant, that opponents, that sort of thing, might not have, sort of information, some additional information beyond what has been presented in the application, the way to deal with that is to bring it up at the meeting and say, hey, I used to work in that particular building. I worked there for 15 years. I haven't worked there in the last 10 years. There have been a bunch of things that have gone on since then. I don't think I'm biased in any way. I don't have any particular attachment to the building or not. But I wanted to make it clear to everyone that you can say that sort of thing. You can actually still vote on that. But you just want to make sure that you do mention it in front of people. Also, public documents. Essentially, any documents you get that are related to city business are public unless they're specifically confidential. You can see too many confidential documents as a planning board. That includes, if you're dealing with city business, emails from personal accounts. We haven't had
And I can think of maybe one time when there has been an issue where someone has asked for those sorts of emails that dealt with the planning board. Is that, so it doesn't happen very often, but just something to keep in mind. If you have questions about this or requests for applications, it's never a problem to ask staff. You can ask Dave, you can ask me. It's just a matter of if you start talking to applicants or opponents or each other about things, that's when you're recording an issue. We're supposed to be here to help you. That's what staff does. During the meeting, first, conflicts of interest. Planning board members are supposed to disclose any financial or other conflicts or bias. The two types of conflicts of interest you see in the ordinance are financial and special interests. Special interests are not very helpful to define, but essentially it means an interest that is different from that of an ordinary citizen. You all live in the city of Bangor, that's fine, but if you have some interest that's peculiar to you, financial or otherwise, you should disclose that. And if you do believe that you or somebody else in the planning board has a possible conflict, you want to disclose that at the beginning of the item in question before it's been talked about, and the other members vote on whether there's a conflict. It's not for you to decide. If you say, I think I have a conflict of interest, this is, you know, I clearly have a conflict of interest, but the rest of the planning board says you don't, then you don't. That's the way that the statute works, or the ordinance works. It kind of takes the pressure off you to a certain extent. And under the planning board bylaws, if you do not have a conflict, you are required to vote, so you don't get to abstain at any point. You have to vote unless you have a conflict. Every decision has to be made based on standards and standards alone. The standards that are in the ordinances and anything the ordinance refer to. Personal opinion as to what is good, what is just common sense, what meets or doesn't meet the Americans with Disabilities Act, what meets or doesn't meet some other code, even if it's a city code. That's not up to you. Your job is to interpret the standards that the planning board works with. In general, that's RSO Chapter 165 of the ordinances. And if there are, say, 10 standards that a project has to meet, and you find that it meets 9 of those standards, but not the 10, and it has to meet those 10 standards, then your job is to reject that project. I would sometimes, in some contexts, there are differences between standards and factors that you're supposed to consider. And generally speaking, the ordinance will be very clear that it's a standard you have to meet, or just something to take into consideration. You just have to take something into consideration. That's not as much of an issue if you say, well, I take this into consideration, but I still find it meets all the standards, that's fine. The final note for the general board I'll say is generally try to avoid talking about irrelevant matters. If the meeting goes faster, it's also important. When you start asking questions about how's this going with the project, I'm not asking as a planning board member, but as a citizen, I know we're not supposed to ask about traffic, but those sorts of questions tend to elicit information that isn't relevant to those standards I was talking about, to the function of the planning board. And if the decision is later challenged either by an applicant or by somebody who doesn't want to see the work done, they can point to that as an improper reason for the decision. The final thing I'll note is something for the chair to keep in mind. Who's the chair? Okay. Your primary responsibility is to run the meeting so it's efficient, clear, and fair. In particular, make sure that people use the microphones for the sake of the record. And if at some point, we haven't really had too many issues but if at some point you had, say, a ton of opponents to a particular project and they started repeating themselves, repeating the last one and said, it is okay to say something. It is okay to put, say, a time limit on people. It should be reasonable. You should be able to the same standard if they're both proponents and opponents. Obviously, the applicant may want more time because they're the ones representing the application in the first place. And then I would just say, for the sake of brevity, I would also try to avoid repeating yourselves and other board members. It is fine in both cases for somebody to say, hey, I just want to echo what that person said. I have the same concerns that they did. That's fine. But in some contexts, we've had times where it's got to go beyond that. We're set same percent, same things again and again and again. So we try to avoid that. Do you have any questions about any of this? Now or in the future?
I'd like to go back to the email.
Yes.
So we get the packet via email. If I saw something that I had a particular question about, I could email somebody on the staff.
Always.
For the information.
Yep.
But what you're saying is I wouldn't email John for the information. I would
Correct.
Email the staff.
Correct.
And then those emails are public record?
They are.
Is that correct?
Yep.
So is everything in that particular email account available?
The way
do I need a separate account for that?
That if you'd like to create a second account for that, you certainly could. The way that we have handled Freedom of Access Act requests typically in the past for state accounts or the front board is we say if we get a request asking for certain information, we pass that request on to you saying, please give us all of this, all of your emails that are relevant to this particular matter, or that have these keywords or something like that. It's possible if we have litigation, it is possible that someone could ask for some of this stuff in discovery, in which case we would still probably be doing something like that. It's possible to say, well, I don't think that's all that there is. I want to, you know, inspect your hard drive or go to Google and get everything. It's never happened. I consider it very unlikely.
And just one more, I just want to be sure. Everything that comes in the packet is public information. It's available on the website. There's nothing confidential because there's no personnel information or
right.
things like that in this particular packet. Is that right?
David, can you think of anything that would ever be confidential?
I like to tell everybody that I talk to that the planning office has virtually zero confidential information. Everything that comes into our office is public information. So if somebody brings us a drawing of a site, as soon as they give it to us, it's public information. So there's very little, if ever, anything that we have that would not be public information. And, you know, all the plans that the board approves, the minutes, scan the plans, we'll send them to anybody that asks for them. So pretty much all of it is fairly...
It's hard to imagine a circumstance where a plan would get... I mean, maybe if it was some guard facility that submitted information, but I don't think they would submit that, such information to us. If there was ever anything that was confidential, we would try pretty hard to plaster the confidentiality all over it and be very careful about how we do that.
Could you mention, talk briefly about the conflict of interest? I know we've talked a little bit about that in past years, about you know, if you work for a firm that is representing the client for a particular project, even if, like in my case, if I didn't work on that project, it's still have a conflict or potential.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and it's ultimately up to you folks. You draw that line. There is some specific language in the conflict of interest provision in Chapter 33 of our ordinances that talks about financial conflicts of interest. You know, if you're directly making money off of it, and I don't have that language right in front of me at the moment, but it's pretty specific. It tends not to be quite that clear. You know, you end up with these questions about, well, I'm not directly working on a project, my firm is making money, and my firm pays me, but does that really count? And ultimately, it's up to the board to make a determination as to whether or not that is a conflict. I wish I could give you better advice on that, but it's really the I think to some extent, I'm guessing what the council would ask that particular ordinance thought, but I'm thinking that it may have been left to some extent deliberately vague, because it's often hard to tell without looking at all these things on a case-by-case basis whether or not it really is a conflict. I mean, David, I don't know whether you have thoughts on what previous planning boards have found to be conflicts or not in those particular types of circumstances.
I don't know that I have any great over the years that could say it goes one way or another. What I would suggest to the board is, if everybody's here and there's a potential that somebody will think you have a conflict, it's best just to step aside and let the other members of the board deal with it. Because it's not always whether you actually have a conflict, it's whether the applicant or the neighbors think there might be some reason that would overshadow your decision. And, you know, if we can avoid that, let's just avoid it.
The only other thing I would say is, it's always, if you think there's any chance, it's always best to bring it up. And that way the rest of the board can make that decision. That's the procedure we have in place. So that way, if at some point there's litigation, there's all sorts of questions about this, at least we can say we followed our procedure, we did things right.
One of the things we might run into would be people who are serving on not-for-profit boards. And that board is presenting something to the planning board for approval. And I think the person who's serving on that board, also in the planning board, has to excuse himself for voting on something like that.
Again, I mean, ultimately, it would be a matter for the planning board to make a decision on that. I think we have had that particular issue arise before, and I honestly don't know off the top of my head where the board came down on it. There are certainly conflicts that I would be more worried about than that, places where it has more to do with a person's own financial interest. But, it's tough. Boards also differ. Sometimes board members are much more involved than others. I think David could give us good advice. Absent anything more about the situation, if it's sort of a question as to whether there's a conflict of interest, it can be safer to just say, we don't think you would make any sort of biased decision, but given that there's a board that you're on, you obviously care deeply about it, it's easier, it's maybe a little safer to just say there is a conflict of interest. But again, it's ultimately up to the board to make that decision. It's also, if you have something that seems like, this really, really doesn't seem like a conflict of interest, I just want to buy someone, you're always welcome to get in touch with me in advance. Any other questions? You've certainly highlighted a couple of areas that are the trickiest ones and the ones that we struggle with the most.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rich. You did a great job.
Come on, thank you.
Thanks for your patience.
No worries.
I hope that was helpful for
Worth it.
Yeah. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, there is the MMA is putting on a Freedom of Access, and I don't have the date, a Freedom of Access workshop in Lewiston. And I want to say it's this month, but I don't know. And for anybody that's interested, I'm considering going over because I'm not too smart, but I just thought I'd point that out, that is something that they're working with, trying to stay on top of the...
Usually one in Ellsworth around about every year, isn't there?
little later?
Well, this is a, that's usually a planning board or a training. Yeah. Training. This would be on.
I saw something about the marijuana, too. I got an email about some MMA training on the marijuana issue.
Yeah. I do have that workshop for you from Maine Municipal Association, Freedom.
Yeah.
It's Lotta Inn, Pleasant Street, Lewiston, Maine. Workshop is 2 to 4:30, and it is on March... Oh, crap, wait a minute.
Right up top, Rich.
March 13th.
13th. There it is. I have it here already. What do you know?
Jeez, look at that.
So that's next Monday.
That's probably in the cloud.
Yeah. Thank you, Rich.
Yes.
Anything else? Sir?
Mr. Chairman, you decided that you wanted to have, I think, public hearing in May on the marijuana thing. Is that correct? Should it be a wise decision to select a date now for that?
Would it be at our May meeting?
I would say so. Yeah. The regular plan.
Well, I don't know. I'm just wondering.
I would assume.
So that was the plan meeting. To have it at your regular May meeting. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
That was my thought. Now.
Well, you always. You know, may bring a big crowd, but of course we don't know what. We know that's going to be on the agenda, but we don't know anything else. But we'll deal with it.
Do any of you have the forms to hand in?
Sure. You want just the back page? Or
just the one that's signed? I can give it all back if you want.
Yeah, there you go.
Anything else? Well, you can keep the pack you read.
Yeah, we don't need this.
I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second. Discussion. Second. All in favor?
Thank you, sir.